papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember
Mr. Media Project is a half-hour commentary analysis on what's going on in the news media with some veteran folks from newsrooms. I'm Rex Smith, the former editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American. Here with my colleagues, we have Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady and vice president of the New York Press Association, Judith.
Hey, hey, hey.
Thank you, Judy. And Barbara Lombardo is here, formerly executive editor of the Saratoga and the Record in Troy, now professor at UAlbany.
Happy to be here.
Happy? Good. Glad you're happy.
I didn't say I was happy. I'm happy to be here.
All right. And Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Kingston Daily Freeman and affiliated publications. Are you doing okay?
I'm doing good, Rex. Nice to see you. Good to be back.
And great to have you here. In fact, Ira's son is in the studio with us. If you need reinforcements, Ira, you call him in. That's the tradition in American politics these days. We've got Donald Trump bringing on his son's doppelganger as his vice presidential candidate. So you could bring in your son to stand in for you if you need to.
No, he drove up here. That was enough of help.
That's good. So we have, since the last time we were here, had an assassination attempt and a national convention. The news just keeps going on. And who knows what may happen between the time that we sit in this studio and folks actually listen to us. So let's take a few steps back and take a look at the media issues surrounding the assassination attempt. And I'll start off by just saying that the thing that stood out for me immediately was, frankly, the incredible image, or actually multiple images, that developed within a few minutes. I was sitting up in the Adirondacks, actually, in a little lakeside place, and a guy across the table from me said something about the photograph that had immediately moved on social media. And of course, it is that iconic photo taken by the AP Evan Vucci, showing Donald Trump with blood coming down his face from his ear wound, his fist raised in the air, an American flag sort of behind him with the blue sky. That image shows that there is still power in non-moving images, I guess, right? In photography.
Absolutely. You don't want something like that to happen, an attempted assassination. But when something big happens, and that was something big, and you get the shot as a professional, that is really something. And that shot told a significant part of the story and becomes iconic.
And it was news in many respects, in part because it got out there so quickly, and the news that Donald Trump had been shot was out there, but you didn't know how he was. When you saw the photo, you go, oh, he's okay. He's up and at him. And he is a great marketer because he had the presence of mind to raise his fist and shout out, fight, I think it was.
Fight, fight, fight.
And, you know, now the debate is how that photo will be used. Well, the journalist's job is to shoot the photo. What happens with the photo isn't entirely within their control going forward.
Well, what struck me about it was that the photographer, and there are two others that have been widely cited for the pictures that they shot, their instinct was not to duck. Their instinct was not to hide themselves from who knew what was unfolding. We only knew the few shots that went off, but we don't know if a wider threat. Yet these guys went in there and were fearless, and they got the picture. They were there to record history, and they did.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that does take bravery and...
I don't know if I would have done it.
If you were a photographer, that's part of your DNA. Interesting side note that because it was an AP photo, and we've talked about in other weeks about how certain newspaper companies or individual companies are dropping or no longer carrying AP. So if you were a news entity that did not carry the AP, you did not have access to what I think is the most important picture of that day.
Yeah, there were two other photos, as you mentioned. There was a New York Times photographer, Doug Mills, who captured the photograph, apparently, of the bullet that whizzed past Donald Trump's head. And a moneymaker, a photographer for Getty, got the picture from down beneath the podium showing Donald Trump's face kind of being squashed on the ground as Secret Service agents piled atop him to protect him.
You know, sometimes you think there are too many photographers covering these events, but then you realize when you see that great variety of shots, important shots, and that was only because there were so many photographers there. The other thing is this happened around 6:15 at night, which meant that this news did not make the front page of a lot of print newspapers.
A really significant issue. Even West Coast newspapers, which usually have an advantage of having time when something happens at the East Coast, the San Francisco Chronicle, for example, actually puts its print edition to bed on Friday night for the Sunday paper, I mean. So even the Sunday paper didn't have anything.
We should explain why that is. The fact is that there are fewer presses and that so much printing of newspapers is being consolidated into specific press sites. So, for example, my former newspaper in Kingston for a number of years has been printed in Albany. And when that occurred, our deadline schedule changed so that stories that we ordinarily would have had in the newspaper had to wait a day because we went to press 2, in some cases, 3 hours prior to when we normally did. And that was the circumstance here. Amazingly, fortuitously for my paper, we did have it across the top of the front page. But many newspapers, I think I've made reference to the museum feature where you can get it online, many of the front pages literally from around the world. And the selection that I looked at, very few of them had that story in the Sunday paper.
Yeah, the Saratogian and the Troy Record were among the papers on the cutting edge of making their deadlines ridiculously early so that the idea of a morning paper that's going to tell you the news that happened last night became a thing of the past. And now that has become increasingly the way to go. It's an economic decision by the owners of the newspapers. You don't get election results. You don't get baseball results. You don't get attempted assassinations. The New York Times didn't have it. And it's just an economic issue and another example of the lack of relevance of the print product these days and what a fabulous job is done with online coverage.
There's also an additional factor just in some of the papers, by the way, for those folks who are still going with that anachronistic print product. A number of newspapers are now delivered by the Postal Service rather than by carriers, which actually also pushes their deadline earlier. They get the dependability of postal delivery, which is sometimes, wouldn't you say, Ira, having overseen a circulation department, sometimes Postal Service could be more dependable than...
Yeah, I think that's... I'm starting to get my paper delivered by the mail, and it's disappointing, understandably necessary. But the irony is, again, I'll use my old newspaper as an example. We were for years an afternoon newspaper delivered by carrier boys and girls, and it was not unusual for your newspaper to arrive at 3:30 in the afternoon. And many newspapers, including mine, switched to morning publication because we wanted to get the news first thing in the morning so people would have it at their breakfast table. And now here we are turned around and we're an afternoon newspaper again by the time it's delivered in the mail.
A 2 day later afternoon sometimes, depending on the news.
Yeah.
So we've been talking here so far about covering the immediate aftermath, covering the news of it. But there comes then the opportunity for commentary. Cable news especially has become a place of commentary, not breaking news coverage. And so pretty shortly after it became clear that Donald Trump was not, in fact, seriously injured in the shooting, we turned back again to commentary in the media. And suddenly the Republican talking point became, let's talk about unity. My goodness, everything has gotten too out of hand in this country. Look at what's happened to Donald Trump. So we need to be more kind to each other and talk about unity. Did that actually happen in the commentary that followed? Is there a responsibility for those of us in the media to pay attention to those calls?
You know, I heard that too, the calls for unity out of one side of their mouth and the divisive characterizations out of the other side of their mouth. And, you know, it would have been a great opportunity for us to talk about gun violence in our country and the availability of AR-15s and, you know, the fact that Secret Service protocols were so easily thwarted. So there are lots of opportunities there. I think talking about unity is great, but you've got to hold their feet to the fire and ask, what exactly are you saying? And isn't that divisive, what you're saying?
Well, what is the definition of unity? In other words, in what is the media's role in unity? I mean, it seems to me the bigger complaint was not whether you are unified. It's the level of discourse that is being expressed by partisans is so over the top frequently that it could in fact lead to a circumstance such as what happened with Trump. That said, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't still cover stories on the opinion pages with views from both sides. In other words, the two sides are not all of a sudden going to have a kumbaya moment. There's still going to be people from this side of the spectrum and that side of the spectrum.
What about the immediate impact, though, of blaming the media? You saw that at the Trump rally right after the shooting, people actually coming up and poking reporters in the chest, saying, you're to blame for this, you're to blame for this. There is certainly a great deal of that among the politicians as well as ordinary citizens.
It's never going to change. It's as old as the institution of there being what we now call media, but in the old days was who knows what, chroniclers or gazetteers or pamphleteers. And blaming the media is easy and it's historic and it's not going to stop.
I agree. And in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I naively thought that we are ushering in a moment of national unity and civility and camaraderie. And that did not last. And I learned never to get suckered into that again. And there was a way to, and still is a way, to comment on nobody wants anybody in politics to become the victim of violence. But come on. There's going to be rhetoric that could be mistaken as violent. Fight, fight, fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody's going to say fight, fight, fight. Doesn't mean actually go out and roll up your sleeves and fight.
Means get the first down on the football field also, or, move the basketball down the court.
If you say bullseye, if you say treat them more harshly, if you say they're going to destroy our democracy, which both sides have been saying.
There is an overt moment, though, also, where you have, for example, J.D. Vance, before he was picked as the vice presidential candidate, his immediate response to the shooting, his first tweet, his first message on X, blamed the Biden campaign for the Trump shooting. He attacked CNN as ghouls for its coverage of the aftermath. And that was blatant on the part of some people.
And gives you an idea of where he is going to be coming from if he is in office.
Right.
That we should be afraid of our liberties in the press.
You know, from my perspective, I thought CNN did a yeoman's job of putting what had happened into perspective, that the potential assassination of a presidential candidate is a huge historical moment for us. And also the idea of trying to make sure to quell, the potential panic in the country. I think they got people on the air quickly who could do just that and downplay the J.D. Vances of the world.
What about the decision by the network brass at NBC to pull Morning Joe on the Monday after the shooting? Initially explained to Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, apparently, as, well, we're going to have wall-to-wall coverage of the ongoing news of the assassination attempt. But in fact, it seems that it was concern about what the commentators who are regularly on Morning Joe might say that might upset the apple cart.
That was terrible. And I don't blame Joe Scarborough the next morning for saying, this is not happening again. Like, believe me, this happens again, I'm walking.
Well, it could have made sense for the reason that they were told, which was we're going to run rolling news coverage and we don't want opinion. And then it turns out that the later afternoon programs that do market opinion were on a schedule. So I think the initial instinct, if we take it as its face value, and there was not fears on the part of the brass at Comcast and MSNBC that somehow this was going to hurt them politically, that it made sense to go with rolling news coverage, but they did not stick with rolling news coverage after the morning show.
Right, or it could have been rolling news coverage that was anchored by the MSNBC Morning Joe team. I thought that was absolutely an indication of a lack of faith in them, and that was a mistake.
NBC has been particularly attacked by Trump in the past, and he has specifically cited NBC as deserving to have its license pulled, which is kind of a misunderstanding of how broadcast licenses happen and what the role of networks is. Notwithstanding that, it seems to me that this is a boss who doesn't understand the imperatives of journalism, that the people who are making the calls at NBC, remember, this is the network that hired Ron McDaniel, the former head of the Republican National Committee, as a commentator, and then had to pull it back when the network on-air talent erupted in criticism. It seems to me that what we have here is a significant player in American journalism, NBC News, being run by people who don't actually have an understanding of the operations of the news. Ira, you know, you came from a news background into a business position as a publisher, but isn't there an importance to having at least an appreciation for the ethic of journalism in your role?
Well, but again, if we're using this particular instance as an example, I happen to think it was not a bad instinct to stick with rolling news coverage and to leave the opinion in the commentary to some other point in time. From a strictly pecuniary standpoint, they shot themselves in the foot by taking off Morning Joe because that's one of their largest profit centers on that channel. And the statistics show that the ratings that morning dipped precipitously. So maybe that's an argument that the ownership wanted to do the right thing and was willing to forego the revenue, but that's what happened.
And well, the shooting was Saturday. The shooting was Saturday. It wasn't even, we're pulling things off because we're covering with breaking news to keep
Sunday.
Everybody.
This is Monday morning.
It's old news. We needed to hear perspectives and a new take on what's going on. And I think that the media has been excessively deferential to Trump.
Some
of the media have been excessively deferential to Trump through the whole GOP convention.
And also, subsequent reporting has indicated it wasn't to have rolling news coverage. They were intentionally trying to keep the opinion off the air. And they really, as of this taping, have not given us a full explanation about what went into their decision-making, and if they would do the same thing again, if presented with a similar set of circumstances.
So to capitalize on Barbara's term, if the media have been deferential during the Republican convention, isn't a mark of that the failure to push back on some of the false statements from the podium, some of the incorrect comments that are being offered, which you don't see so much being checked in real time or even in the immediate aftermath? When you have claims by speakers like Carrie Lake or Nikki Haley, Steve Scalise, a Republican leader of the House, saying that the borders have been opened up to the entire world, prisons are being emptied across America's borders, which is simply not true. Nikki Haley saying that, there are just a number of these that deserve to have a fact check, but I wonder if in deference to the concerns of half of America seeming to support Donald Trump now, according to polling, are networks being overly cautious in exercising their fact-checking responsibility?
Well, CNN, I've been watching CNN as a go-to. It's like dating back to the CNN origin. When there was breaking news, people turned to CNN, and that sort of has changed as with the growth of MSNBC and particularly Fox. But CNN has been, I think, very responsible. And in fact, to your point, Rex, they have a fact checker named Daniel Dale, who was on when needed, in particular after Peter Navarro's speech at the convention on the third night. Daniel Dale came in and pointed out where he was wrong or exaggerated. So it is being done, but it doesn't hurt to have more of that.
Mm-hmm. The notion that rising crime is, that crime is rampant in America.
That's right.
In fact, crime has diminished, including homicide, during the Biden term. Senator Scott of Florida saying that under Donald Trump, we weren't at war, when in fact we were in Afghanistan throughout his presidency, and military force was used elsewhere during the Trump term. So fact-checking is an important part of it. And I have people who are friends of mine who push back at it and say, why do you guys not just let people have their say? And of course, our answer is our job is to give people a true picture of what lies beyond their own experience, not to give them just what people say.
We too often give people their say without pointing out the lies or the errors in what they're saying. The Poynter Institute, which is a journalism think tank and training institute, had gone through what had happened during the first two or three days of the convention and pointed out, as you were alluding to, Rex, things that were said and whether they were true or false. And I think all but maybe one of the major things were false, either false or mostly false. So part of it is doing what Daniel Dale does so well.
Yeah, they
CNN.
Also, another major complaint of the Republicans is the immigration, which they're pointing as Biden's fault. It needed to be reported, and it was, at least in the segment that I saw, that they had an agreement, a bipartisan agreement, that was snuffed at Trump's behest because it would help Trump to have this immigration as an issue. So, and again, It has been reported, but you know, when you're watching TV, you can't be sitting there all day waiting for it unless you're a shut-in, and you may miss some of it.
Right.
This.
In this era, don't you think there should be some technical way of doing it with a pop-up? But if you did that, wouldn't that be criticized as trying to step all over their speech?
It is done, actually. If you follow the live coverage online, say, of the New York Times reporters, which is how I watch a lot of news events these days, you will see them in real time as quickly as they can, coming back within 60 seconds, say, of something. And you would think with the large news teams that some have available, that's possible. The Washington Post, for example, the example is given, there were only two reporters for the Washington Post, two journalists on the ground at the Trump rally when he was shot. Within an hour, 250 Washington Post journalists were involved in the coverage. Isn't that astounding?
It is astounding.
Imagine having a newsroom that big.
There's another thing that
I hired that many people in my lifetime.
But that number of people could be put into service of fact-checking if you actually, because we know the talking points of all these politicians. So there, to your point, Judy, there could be some sort of a technological workaround so that you could have real-time fact-checking.
There's another thing that the journalists and news organizations can do, since there is a kind of a given that when people are in a political convention, they're going to say things that you know is just going to be whatever. But then when the other side, say in the Democrats, are trying to point out the lies, the misinformation that is being told, when they want to tell it, then we have a responsibility as journalists to report their refutation of the lies. And I think sometimes we just shrug our shoulders. Oh, we already heard from them. They already had a chance to say that wasn't true. I don't think there's enough of that.
Joe Biden made this point, actually, in the interview with Lester Holt, where he said, why didn't you guys report about the 28 lies that Donald Trump spoke during the debate? Why are you focusing on my performance rather than that? Is that a valid criticism?
No, it's not a valid criticism. And I think you guys started discussing this last week. First of all, Biden had opportunity himself to make that very argument to Trump when he met him face to face. Wait a minute, sir, you're lying. That's number one. Number two, for how long has the press been reporting on Trump's misstatements, exaggerations, or flat-out lies? It's not new. It wasn't the news of that debate. The news of the debate was Biden's horrific performance. So it's the Trump situation has certainly not been ignored by any media.
So the news of the debate was the Biden implosion, let's say. But that doesn't obviate the need to point to the lies of Trump, does it?
In this case, I think that the Biden performance was so catastrophic that it would have been malfeasance if the reporting was not about that, particularly when Trump's circumstances baked into the cake. We know what he's about. We know what he's doing. And there was time in the days after to catch up to that.
Before we leave this and talk about one more issue other than politics, I want to just point out that the great irony of Eric Trump, being on the air on CNN saying, if you have disagreements on political issues, that's fine, but it should not be demonized. Now, how odd that a Trump is saying don't demonize people when that's, of course, what they're saying. And even as he was saying that, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, was on the platform behind him on stage giving a speech in which he described Democratic policies as a clear and present danger to America. And when Senator Johnson was confronted with that being contrary to his plea for lowering the volume, he said, oh, it was the wrong teleprompter speech.
The wrong speech
got loaded into the teleprompter. That is, wow.
Yeah, he could have stopped and said, hey, there's a wrong speech on the teleprompter. Can someone load the right one?
I'll tell you something that made me mad in some of the coverage that I saw. It was the first night of the convention when Trump shows up as a spectator, but it was the first time he'd been out in public since the shooting. The commentators were reading his facial language, for want of a better phrase, saying he seems to have mellowed. It's a different Trump. What were they thinking?
That is irresponsible.
Just nonsense.
Yeah. So I need to get to this one other topic before here. Congress is considering legislation that would require automobiles to have access to AM radio, AM radio for every vehicle act, directing Secretary of Transportation to issue a rule requiring automakers to continuing building vehicles with AM access. This is completely off topic from what we've been talking about, but I just want to bring it up as an interesting point in reaching all of America. In the midst of the advanced technology that we're dealing with, it is interesting to note that a lot of people in a lot of places in America and in emergencies can't get information in the ways in which we're now accustomed to sending it to people.
Well, if this thing goes through, and I don't understand fully the negatives to including and continuing to include AM radios, but if in fact there are no more AM radios in automobiles, that is the end of the AM radio business, and there are going to be closures of stations who are going to lose audience. You know, there's one thing to say you can now get digital on your cars, you can listen to FM on your cars, but it's a number of people still do listen to AM radio, and if they're not there, they're not going to be substituted.
Well, it's because of the frequency. It's because AM will carry in places where FM can't be heard.
But why do they want to get rid of AM? One of the reasons that's been cited is that it somehow technically interferes with the electric
vehicle operation, supposedly.
Yeah. Yeah, I covered radio many years ago in my days as a reporter, and I came to appreciate the value of AM radio, especially in rural areas, and especially in times of emergency when other things are not working. One of the things that this station, WAMC, gives away is a crank radio, because
Yay.
When the power's out, you need access to emergency information about what roads are closed, when the power's coming back on, where to get your fresh water. I mean, AM radio is incredibly important in those circumstances.
There may even be a few people who hear this program at 1400 AM, WAMC AM, which is interesting. How about that? And we thank you if you join us there. And we thank all of you for joining us this week. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, Ira Fussfeld, and I'm Rex Smith. With thanks to our producer, Dave Gassina, and to you folks for joining us this week. We hope we'll see you next week once again on The Media Project.
Get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspaper men are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith. Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette. Barbara Lombardo, Adjunct Professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian and Daily Freeman Publisher Emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.